You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko otou toku ingoa, nau mai hare mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Ra'apa Wednesday. I'm your temporary host Otto, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Rawan. If I ake nei coming up on the show, for our regular catch-up, I speak to the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March about the government's decision to boost Pharmac funding, the introduction of a new sentencing category for young offenders, and the implementation of check-in requirements for those on the job seeker benefit. I also speak to Susan St. John from the University of Auckland to talk about assistance gaps in the Working for Families scheme. And I speak to Paula Lorgelli, also from the University of Auckland, for her perspective on the government's recent Pharmac funding announcement. Rawan, what have you got for us today?
This morning I spoke to Bianca Ranson from Forest and Bird about the Hauraki Gulf Protection Bill being recommended to Parliament in its entirety. I also spoke to Aaron Hendry from Kickback about the petition against the Ram Raid Bill.
Hey, aha, o whakaro. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātui mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rane, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware e āhe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēne kōrero anō hi pakihere roki-roki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi pohome haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
The government recently announced it would increase funding to the New Zealand Pharmaceutical Agency, also known as Pharmac, by $604 million over the next 4 years to fund the treatment of 54 new drugs, 13 of which are cancer-treating medications. The announcement came after the government experienced widespread backlash when cancer treatment funding was left out of the annual budget announcement made last month, going against the National's promise during the general elections to increase funding for certain cancer treatments. For our weekly catch-up, I spoke to the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March to discuss the party's take on the government's recent announcement and decision. We also talked about the government's introduction of a new sentencing category for young offenders and the implementation of check-in requirements for job seeker beneficiaries. The government recently announced a $604 million increase in funding to Pharmac over the next 4 years to cover 54 new medicines, including 26 cancer drugs. What's the Green Party's take on this?
Look, of course we welcome additional funding for cancer drug treatments, but the reality is what we need is tax reform to adequately and sustainably fund Pharmac, which is the agency that procures those life-saving medicines, rather than playing political football at the election around specific drugs. Additionally, the other key point is that because of the way the government has done it, they've now left very little money in future budgets for any initiatives, which means any interventions in the health system will be greatly reduced in years to come because of that lack of political courage to have tax reform to fund our health system and fund those life-saving medicines.
The decision comes after the government received quite a large amount of backlash for leaving out cancer drug funding from the budget announcement last month. Do you think that both the announcement and the amount of funding was prompted by the criticism, or do you think that the government was already on the way to funding cancer treatments?
I think the public can see it for itself that the government did break a promise, and after a huge amount of backlash, they had to basically use money for future budgets to be able to cover the costs of those medicines. At the end of the day, what this speaks of is the need to stop playing political football over cancer drugs and actually resource Pharmac adequately so that more life-saving medicines can be funded.
Subsequently, what do you think about the government dipping into next year's budget to pay for cancer treatments?
Well, it's irresponsible, and it's completely in line with a government that refuses to tax the wealthy few to fund our public services, including life-saving medicines, by funding Pharmac. The reality is that now the government has even less money to support our health infrastructure, our frontline health services, our GPs, and the people who actually support people prevent getting sick in the first place.
Lastly, are there any other gaps to medicine access and cancer treatment access that you think the government needs to address as well?
Well, one of the key things that PharmEc needs to do better is around the community consultation to ensure that they're making decisions based on community needs. But that goes back to the lack of adequate and sustainable funding for PharmEc. We reject the government's move to fund medicines based on how they impact productivity for workers, because that sets a really dangerous precedent for disabled people around eugenics-based decisions based on how many people we can get back to work based on how those medicines work, as opposed to just how well they enable those people to live their lives.
Okay, moving on to the next topic. The government recently introduced the Young Serious Offender Sentencing Category that would allow judges to send offenders between the ages of 14 to 17 to military-style academies. What's the Green Party's take on this?
Well, this is, once again, government completely ignoring evidence and going ahead with programs that have actually done very little domestically and internationally to prevent reoffending. The Prime Minister himself said it on Monday, that he actually does not care about the evidence. He just wants to try something different. And what we know from the evidence is that if we invest in issues such as housing, income support, and allow parents to be in the best position to raise children, that we actually can reduce youth offending rather than setting kids down a path of criminalization and reoffending, as military-style boot camps have proven here in New Zealand and overseas.
While speaking to The Wire yesterday, National MP Tom Rutherford said that the boot camps would be a new style of military academy with significant changes being made to how they were previously implemented in the 80s and 90s. How would you respond to this?
Oh, look, they're going off vibes, and there is enough evidence domestically and overseas to show us that those academies don't work. We've just had Autism New Zealand come into Parliament today, and they told us how neurodivergent children are often criminalized and how services to rehabilitate them often don't meet their needs. And so the reality is that military-style academies to rehabilitate people don't work. We need investments in the areas that prevent crime in the first place and genuine rehabilitation interventions to support people, particularly young people who may find themselves criminalized, rather than putting them in an experiment that hasn't been shown to work.
Okay, moving on to the last topic for today. The government recently announced it would be implementing a work check-in requirement for those on the job seeker benefit, and that they would have to attend a seminar every 6 months to discuss their job search progress. What's the Green Party's take on this?
We've been really clear that this is a government that cares more about punishing people rather than supporting them into work. The key thing with these check-ins is that we know from evidence that they're not tailored and they don't actually connect people to jobs that meet their skills and aspirations. This is about a government that has a goal of getting 50,000 people off the benefit, and it doesn't matter whether those people go off to work or simply off the benefit. And this shows that the government is just putting in place interventions that allow MSD workers to sanction beneficiaries, take away their income, get them off the benefit, as opposed to getting people into good-paying employment.
Does it feel like a bit of an insult to injury that the government is coming down harder on job seeker beneficiaries in the middle of a wave of unemployment caused by public sector cuts?
It is rich for the government to cut around 6,000 jobs from the public sector and then talk about the need to get people into employment. As I've said many times, this is not a serious government, and certainly not a government that is serious about getting people into good paying secure jobs. This is a government that wants to cut off access to income support at any cost to be able to produce tax cuts. And this is why the Greens have been fighting for to end poverty, but then also to have systems that connect people to jobs that meet their goals and aspirations rather than any shitty job that does not actually support someone in the long term.
Since 2017, the amount of people on the benefit has increased by 70,000, with 40,000 people having been on the benefit for more than a year. Wouldn't you agree that the government needs to take stronger action to ensure that people come off the benefit and that they aren't abusing the support they receive from taxpayers?
Well, that's implying that people on the benefit are inherently abusing the support system that they have. And I think that the key thing here for us is that actually what we need is a strong income support system. We need to recognize that many people on the benefit are actually doing critical work to our economy, such as caregiving, raising children, looking after our elderly. And some of that work actually does not get recognized within the welfare system as contributions. And many people who are on job seeker support are disabled people who actually should be on a different type of benefit and haven't been enabled to have the right assessments to move on to things like the supported living payment. And we will never achieve any of those things if the government keeps being single-mindedly focused on getting people off the benefit other than prioritizing things like ending poverty and creating good-paying, secure jobs.
Lastly, how would the Green Party address unemployment and try to get New Zealanders off the benefit?
Well, we simply don't think that getting New Zealanders off the benefit is a useful goal in and of itself. When it comes to addressing unemployment, one of the key things that we can do is ensuring that people have the support that they need, for example, when they're raising a family, so that you don't have to choose between looking after your children and remaining in unemployment. And additionally, what we would do is ensuring that we continue bolstering initiatives like Jobs for Natures, which actually supported many people to enter employment from when they were receiving a benefit, rather than cutting those initiatives and actively driving up employment by manufacturing job losses to lower inflation.
That was Green MP Ricardo Menendez-March talking to us about the Farm Act funding boost, the new sentencing category for young offenders, and check-in requirements for those on the benefit.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
There are at least 150,000 children in Aotearoa living under the poverty line who come from households dependent on government assistance schemes like Working for Families, which assist low-income families with childcare and accommodation costs. However, as Susan St. John, Associate Professor in Economics at the University of Auckland Business School and spokesperson for Child Poverty Action Group, said in a recent Newsroom article, there are barriers to accessing assistance in schemes aimed at supporting low-income families that are not found in those aimed at Kiwis over the age of 65, such as NZ Super. I had a chat with Susan about the state of government assistance for low-income families in Aotearoa and why she believes it's better to be old than young if you're poor in New Zealand. To start off, are low-income families able to access support easily under the Working for Families scheme?
Not particularly. Most families will be getting the family tax credit because that goes to all low-income children on the same basis, and it seems to have a very high uptake. The other part of Working for Families, called the in-work tax credit, performs the same function. It just goes to meet the needs of children, but it has different criteria. And these criteria have been softened in recent years. You used to have to work a fixed number of hours per week to qualify. They've taken that away. However, you do have to have attachment to the paid workforce and be completely free of the benefit system. So you can't have any part benefit, working part-time or anything like that. And the difficulty is that when we're in tricky times, as we are at the moment, with quite a serious recession and families are losing work, and of course there's the natural disasters as well, where families can be thrown in complete disarray and lose hours of work or lose jobs altogether, they may not realise that they're not entitled to the full Working for Families package, and if they continue to receive it, further down the track they're going to get a big bill from the Inland Revenue Department.
What kind of criteria do households need to go for to apply for Working for Families?
Well, they have to have a child, obviously, and you need to have both parents' income to determine the amount of Working for Families. So it's a fairly simple procedure in the IRD system, or if you're on a benefit, then you can get it paid through the Ministry of Social Development. If you're on a benefit, of course, you only get the family tax credit part. You don't get the in-work tax credit.
Can you tell us about why there seem to be less barriers in accessing NZ Super for Kiwis over the age of 65 than for younger households on Working for Families?
Yes, that's a really interesting question. I think overall, what we've done is we've sent the older in a special category, and they can have their pension without any concerns about whether or not they're in paid work. It's completely unconditional money. and it's simple to access, and it's not abated. Abated meaning that it's reduced as people get more income. So when we look at working for families, if parental income is over $42,700, which is an amount that's been fixed for a very long time, every extra dollar means they're entitled to 27 cents less of their working for families. So let's take a family at the moment that earns over $48,000 and maybe look at that extra dollar over $48,000. It's taxed at 30%, so that's a loss of 30 cents. And then there's another loss of working for families, 27 cents. And that's actually a real disincentive to earn that extra dollar.
Why does it seem like the government might be more lenient for, you know, retirees and people over the age of 65 than for younger families?
Well, historically, we've had politicians who've got themselves into political strife when they've tried to meddle with the state pension. Go back to 1991, where Ruth Richardson tried to change it into a welfare benefit. And there was such an outcry that they had to go back to the status quo. And politicians have some sort of implicit agreement, left and right, that somehow the pension is sacrosanct. And it applies to other aspects of what we do for older people as well. So there's universal free transport for people over 65. Sometimes there's some restrictions on the hours, but it's a very valuable universal payment, which you don't have to qualify for by filling in difficult forms and getting less of if you earn extra money. And then there's a winter energy payment that goes to all superannuitants, regardless of whether they actually need it or not. So we've had a very liberal attitude to supporting the old, and that's been quite good because at least we know that we've been reasonably successful in preventing poverty. Whether or not we can afford it in the future is another matter, but at least we've kept most older people from being in hardship. Not all, and it isn't quite as good as it used to be. But we've never really had the same commitment to protecting the young. And I find that quite surprising. And in part, I think it's because we've set up working for families. It's very complicated. And people don't want to get their heads around what a tax credit is. It's just a payment. And also, I think there's a lot of stigma and discrimination against beneficiaries.
Debt owed by households receiving working for families increased by $42 million within the past 9 months and had been increasing for the past few years. Can you tell us why that is?
Well, there's two reasons. When families earn more than they thought they were going to earn, they don't realise very often that it means that they're not entitled to as much working for families. So further down the track, when the IRD actually sees how much both parents have earned, they can come along and say, look, you've been overpaid, here's a bill for $3,000, something like that. So that's one way. The other way is the way that I've talked about, which is when we're in a recession and families lose their hours of work, they can become unentitled to the in-work tax credit bit. And further down the track, when the IRD finds out, then they can get a bill for repayment, which then is a debt that they have to repay. And what we've seen is that working for families debt has doubled since 2018. And it's actually a really serious thing because it comes on top of a lot of other debt that families are accumulating. And so they're in a debt spiral.
Back in 2021, David Seymour said that working for families should be abolished entirely and that the assistance received under the scheme could be supplemented with income tax reductions. So first, I'd like to ask how you'd respond to that statement. And secondly, what do you think statements like these mean now that David Seymour and ACT are officially in our government?
Actually, it's a complete nonsense. What he's saying is that society's got no obligation to help support families when they've got young children. And when we look at other developed countries, every other developed country has got a system whereby they offer financial support when there are young children. And in New Zealand, we've got paid parental leave as well as working for families, and we've got subsidies for childcare. All those sorts of things are very common in the OECD. And if we were to take them away, well, to be quite honest, you would have families living in tents on the street. It would just be a third world country. So it's a complete nonsense, and he wouldn't get away with saying it nowadays.
How does New Zealand fare in comparison to other OECD countries when it comes to providing assistance for young people and families?
Well, I think we stand out as being quite unusual in that we discriminate against the poorest children. So if we look at Australia, for example, they've got a system of family tax credits, which overall are on the more generous side than New Zealand, but they don't make any distinction when a family is on a part benefit or a benefit. So the amount paid for the child is the same, and that's highly sensible. Other countries, it's quite difficult to compare, but you take countries, Scandinavian countries, of course, and they do far better in supporting young families with children than New Zealand does. We have got a very high rate of extreme poverty, deep poverty amongst families. So those families under the 40% lowest, which is the lowest poverty line, they're really in extreme hardship, and we just don't have a system that recognises how bad that problem is for society.
And that was Susan St. John from the University of Auckland talking to us about the Working for Families scheme and disparities between different government assistance programs in Aotearoa. We'll be back after this short break with Love Letter by Crystal Chen.
I must be crazy for loving you this way. You mess it up, I say. I close that door, seems to open up some more.
Not your regular night at the movies. The Vista Foundation 48 Hours Auckland City Finals is on. Sky City Theatre, Saturday, June 29th.
Strap in for a rollercoaster ride of laughter and thrills with 15 spectacular, bizarre and debatably genius short films made by local filmmakers in only 48 hours.
Plus, find out who will take out the Auckland City Awards.
The Vista Foundation 48 Hours Auckland City Finals. Sky City Theatre, Saturday, June 29th, 7 p.m. Tickets from eventfinder.co.nz.
Okay, Meadow, we can't lose again, or it's off to the factory. Go, Meadow, go! No, other way! Don't you want to live?
Gonna get there, good horse! Headway wins the Spring Cup!
Oh, no, Meadow. I won't let them take you, Meadow. We'll find a way. I just saw a documentary about a basketball-playing Labrador. Maybe you can learn an unconventional sport too.
Pony Ping Pong with Matt and Aaron, bringing as much entertainment to your Friday night as a Shetland pony skee-balling the table edge. With a mix of mashdowns, candid conversation, cheap shots and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong, Friday, 9 till 11 p.m., only on 95BFM.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
The Environment Committee has unanimously recommended that the Hauraki Gulf Protection Bill should be passed in its entirety. This means that if Parliament votes for this recommendation, there will be 19 new protection areas in the Tikapa Moana Hauraki Gulf Marine Park. Many environmental organizations have welcomed this possibility and highlighted its importance. This morning, I spoke with Bianca Ranson from Forest and Bird about what this new bill would mean, why it is important, and how it incorporates local iwi and hapu values. So there's a lot of excitement for this new bill, which, if there are enough votes, will result in 19 new protection areas within the Hauraki Gulf. Can you give us an overview of what these new protection areas would look like?
So the new protection areas in the Hauraki Gulf Tikapa Moana Marine Protection Bill will see two extensions to currently existing marine reserves. So one of them is at Okakari Point and the other one is at Te Whanganui o Hei. So people may more commonly know them as the Godata Marine Reserve and Cathedral Cove Marine Reserve. And additionally, there will also be 12 HPAs established, which are high protection areas, and then there'll be another 5 SPAs, which are seafloor protection areas.
Why is this step so important now more than ever?
The Hauraki Gulf is in serious trouble in terms of the well-being of the ocean, and that has been in decline for the past 120 years. And the main reasons for that is due to sedimentation, overfishing, which is both commercial and recreational, pollution, as well as governance. And so in 2000, the Hauraki Gulf was determined to be, or it was passed through law, that it, and it became a marine park. And since then, every 3 years, there's a report that comes out that's called State of the Gulf. Those reports have been coming out since then, and every 3 years, it just continues to tell us about the decline of the ocean and the ecosystems. And so one of the more recent threats that we also have is exotic caulerpa, which has been identified in several parts of the Hauraki Gulf and is spreading rapidly. And we also know the impacts on benthic habitats or seabed ecosystems and habitats that bottom trawling has. And so there's a lot at stake within the Gulf just because of the decline that it's already in. But also we have these kind of ongoing threats that are that we're facing as well. So having these 19 protection areas set in place will provide, well, at the moment there's about 0.3% of the Hauraki Gulf is in high protection, and this bill will increase that to 6% high protection with an additional 12% of seafloor protection. So what we really, really want to see is we want to see 100% of the seafloor of the Hauraki Gulf protected, and that would mean an end to bottom trawling. Dredging is no longer able to take place in the Hauraki Gulf because all of the scallop beds have now collapsed, and we also need to see central government allocating really good resources to be able to deal with the threat of exotic caulerpa.
Now, it's also been made clear that this bill will incorporate the wishes of the local community. Can you tell us how the values of the local iwi and hapu is being considered in this?
Yeah, so the Marine Protection Bill has come out of a lot of work that has happened over the past decade. And so that started off with sea change, and then to put that into action was through the process of what's called revitalizing the Gulf. And so what that meant is that the creation of it was really about communities and whānau hapū and stakeholders coming together to put together a plan, and it was an opportunity to create that with the intention of giving effect to Te Tiriti. It's a really good example of how when you have that involvement of and leadership particularly, and I just want to say that the leadership that we have seen from hapū throughout Te Kapa Moana, the Hauraki Gulf, has been incredible, and it's been the leadership that has really been able to put protection in place at very short notice, I guess, compared to how long, you know, legislation takes to go through with the placing of Vahui and also the incredible work that's been done around caulerpa. And so the Marine Protection Bill, I think, sets a precedence and shows that there is a really effective pathway for us to work together as tangata whenua, as communities, side by side with the common goal and vision of having healthy and thriving ecosystems and ocean within the Hauraki Gulf. And hopefully that can also be applied to other places around the motu. So it's about the collective working together, having an understanding of the importance and connection between Te Tiriti and our environment, and the importance of mātauranga and traditional knowledge being applied to restore the Māori of Te Kapa.
Now, obviously this bill will mean that many necessary restrictions will be put in place. How does Council plan to enforce those restrictions?
So the HPAs and the SPAs have got set out in them in the legislation ways that they will be managed. So those areas will be no take. So the high protection areas, for example, people will not be able to take anything from those areas, and if they do, then there will be, just like with Arahui, you know, once that has gone through the Fisheries Act under Section 186A, then there's consequences for people who decide to take from them. And that'll be the same within these HPAs. There is customary take has been allowed within those HPAs, which means that any of that take is non-commercial. That is really critical and essential to the continuation of lived experience and practices in Mātauranga from hapū within those areas. I think that there is going to be opportunity for communities to also be involved in the education around how people can and can't interact within those spaces.
And finally, what is the expected outcome, both short-term and long-term, of this bill?
So the announcement that we've just had is a really good one. So basically, the bill has now finished the select committee stage, and so the Environment Committee unanimously supported the bill to be passed with minor amendments. And that's really significant because it shows that there's cross-party support, which is incredibly important. But I think that it's also important that people understand that often legislational bills can be at their most vulnerable during the second and the third reading. And so for people who are listening, and if you live around the Hauraki Gulf or on one of the islands within the Hauraki Gulf, which is where I am at the moment, is that we can still put pressure on and have a voice. And so one thing that people can do is directly email the Prime Minister to inform him that it's really crucial and important that this bill goes through, and also members of parliament as well. So it's not through yet. It's still got a process to go through, and it's extremely important that we see this bill pass and that we don't stop here. So one of the commitments that has been made is that we need to protect 30% of the Hauraki Gulf by 2030. And as I mentioned before, in terms of high protection in the Gulf, this bill will only set in place 6% high protection. And of course, the additional call for there to be, in the end, a complete end to bond trawling in the Gulf. And we need to advocate to central government as much as we can, and also educate ourselves as people who care about the Hauraki Gulf, as people who live around it, about the real threat that a kalupa poses to the well-being of the ocean as well. So I'm a campaigner with Forest and Bird, specifically with the Hauraki Gulf, and people can also reach out if they want more information of how to get involved.
That was Forest and Bird campaigner Bianca Ranson talking to us about the recommendation to pass the Hauraki Gulf Protection Bill.
You know, our call is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay. It's BFM.
The
Wire.
The coalition government is planning to continue with the passing of the Ramraid Bill, which was originally introduced by the Labour government. This bill would mean that youth offenders as young as 12 years old would be prosecuted more harshly, with some potentially serving up to 10 years in prison. Many organizations and activists have been vocal about their opposition to this bill from the beginning, and many have now started a petition to stop its continuation. I spoke with Aaron Hendry, co-founder of Kickback, an organization that focuses on assisting youth in homelessness, and have also been heavily involved in this petition. I asked Aaron about what the harmful impacts of this bill are and what this new opposing campaign is about. To start off, can you tell us a little bit about what Kickback is all about?
Yeah, so Kickback is youth phenomenal. We are responding to youth homelessness. It's about creating innovative solutions for young people who experience homelessness. One of our key projects is called The Front Door, which is just launching this month, which is a place for young people who are at risk of homelessness to drop in, get support, get care, aroha and love, and advocacy to ensure that they don't slip through the cracks.
The Ramraid Bill saw a lot of pushback from the beginning, with many saying that this will be severely harmful to our youth. Before we dive into the petition, can you share your thoughts on what these harmful impacts are?
So, you know, Kickback's a part of a group of over 30 organisations now who have said, look, we're concerned about this bill, we're concerned that it doesn't follow best practice, it doesn't look at the evidence, and it's really failing to respond to the reasons why children come in from conflicts with the law in the first place. You know, primarily one of our concerns is that it breaches the rights of children. It doesn't respond to children in a way that fits with their development and their stage of development, and it risks further criminalising children as young as 12 and pushing them into a pathway of long-term interaction with the justice system. And that can be hugely detrimental to that young person's both their development, their identity, but also to their health, their well-being and their future.
Can you tell us about how this petition started and elaborate on who else is involved?
There's over 30 organisations. And these organisations who, you know, are experts in youth development and care for children, who have devoted years and years, and hundreds of years in some cases, of engaging and supporting children. You know, groups like Voice Whakaranga Mai, Save the Children, Save Our Children, Amnesty International. And many others that have said, look, we're really concerned about this. So the petition came about because as a sector, as a community, we were concerned. We saw the bill. We recognised that it was not going to serve our children, our communities, or even our wider whānau. I think this is a really important point. The debate has really been around, look, how do we keep our community safe? This doesn't achieve that. There is no evidence that this bill will actually prevent harm from occurring in our communities. Actually, all the evidence we have is that when you punish children who are already severely harmed, when you use punitive measures, you are more likely to increase the harm in our community because you don't prevent that harm and you actually set those kids up for a cycle of ongoing interaction with the jail.
Now, there has been a recent statistic from April that showed that ram raids are down by 80% from last year, and many are crediting that to this bill. How would you respond to this?
Well, the bill has come into play yet. So right now the bill is before the select committee, so you know, the two things don't really marry up. You know, when we look at sort of how we do respond currently, there's already some things that are working. So the last government also introduced the Fast Track program, which is basically a response to a community call to have government agencies and community working together more collaboratively. So it brings, you know, government, community to the table and ensures we can do a wraparound approach and really respond to what's going on. And I think it's around 76%, I think is the number, of young people that have been referred through that channel have not reoffended. So that's hugely successful. When we look over a decade, youth crime has gone down. It continues to go down because we are focusing on evidence-based policy, you know, wraparound support, ensuring that we can engage early and that we actually give both the young people and their whānau a lot more support. There is a small group of young people where there is a challenge, where we're not having as much success as we need to be, and that's because of the bigger social impact on these young people. Young people who are experiencing homelessness, who they and their whānau are in poverty, who do not have the support to manage their, you know, complex needs. And this is where the government could be focusing. It's a real opportunity. It's a small group of young people. We know their whānau, we know their communities. The government could be investing significantly to alleviating the suffering those communities are facing and responding to the core needs that those children have.
Now, building on that, what type of specific action would you want to see from the government to tackle crime amongst youth?
Yeah, look, the government's already acknowledged that they're going to continue with the Fast Track program. I think that's really good. We need to expand that, continuing to expand that, and we need to pour resources into that so that when, you know, a government agency or a community agency says, look, we can see a need here, we can see a young person struggling, we can actually get involved and respond to that. And if the case is that you've got a family that are living in emergency accommodation, we're able to get that whole whānau into housing and address that need. If the case is that you have a child who's literally living on the street and that is the core reason why they are becoming involved in this behaviour in the first place, we can actually ensure that we house those young people. And so it looks like ensuring that we're addressing those core reasons why these children are ending up in the situations they're ending up. You know, we can do a lot more than what we're doing, but we don't achieve anything by ignoring the evidence. What we should be doing is saying, look, what does the evidence say? Where is the success we've had in the system? Now, how do we lean into that evidence, double down on it, and actually ensure for this small group of young people we're adequately responding out of an evidence-based framework? So we can have success in this space, but right now the concern is that we're ignoring what we know about how we improve outcomes for our children and our communities and doubling down on what is fairly punitive rhetoric and lacks evidence to actually achieve the results that we all want, which is more connected, vibrant, supportive communities where we all thrive.
That was Kickback co-founder Aaron Hendry talking about the petition to stop the ram raid bill. We'll be back after a short break.
Man of faith. burning. Oh, what a day. What a day, what a day. The man that knows something knows that he knows nothing at all. Does it seem colder in your summertime and higher in your fall? If we were made in his image, then call us by our names. Most intellects do not believe in God, but they fear us just the same. Oh, the God job.
As part of the ongoing discussions around the government's recent decision to boost pharmac funding for select drugs and cancer patients, I spoke to Paula Lorgelli, Professor of Health Economics and Population Health at the University of Auckland, for her perspective on the announcement as an economist. Here is that interview. To start off, how do you feel about the government's recent pharmac funding announcement?
I think it's great. It's great news for patients. It's great news for pharmac. It allows pharmac to remain and keep their independence without having political interference. It allows them to fund not just 13 new cancer drugs, but up to 54 new drugs, so 26 cancer drugs and 28 other drugs. So I think it's great.
Would you say that cancer patients can now feel a sense of relief about when they'll be able to receive their treatments?
No, unfortunately, I wouldn't say that. And that's because the many of the drugs won't come on board until October. And actually, some of the funding is for next year. So there'll still be some patients who have to wait. And the nature of these drugs is that they're in the later lines of treatment when patients are much more poorly, much more unwell, and many of them may not survive until October to actually benefit from many of these drugs.
The amount of money allocated towards funding cancer treatments actually exceeds a lot of what National promised for pharmac funding in the general elections. However, the announcement also comes after a lot of criticism when funding was left out of last month's budget announcement. Do you think that the government would have allocated this much funding regardless of the criticism it received?
No, I think the government had to allocate this much funding. My understanding is that they've had to fund or suggest they'll fund up to 54 new drugs because of trying not to interfere with the prioritisation list that's confidential to Pharmac. So they knew they wanted to fund some cancer drugs and they couldn't just bump them up the prioritisation list. Hence, they've had to offer more funding in order to maintain the rigour that's behind that prioritisation list, the scientific advice they receive. So I suspect they're having to fund more than they were expecting to fund.
There are concerns from a small number of local economists that the funding increase might take too much of a chunk out of next year's budget, that it could detract from funding needed to tackle inflation, and that further public sector cuts may be needed to accommodate for it. How would you respond to that?
Well, with the budget, it's always a trade-off, right? So, yes, it's coming out of next year's budget, so what's going to give? And is it spending in other areas? Well, I guess we don't know. There's clear need for spending in other areas. I might argue that maybe we should have less tax cuts and actually increase the pot of money that we have available to fund public sector spending, including pharmac spending, by increasing their tax take. So we always have to make trade-offs. In this case, you know, it's for pharmaceuticals. It also does require some funding within the health system to deliver these drugs as well. So that is going to be a necessary cash injection for a very crippled healthcare system at the moment.
Earlier, you mentioned that the recent announcement would allow cancer patients to receive treatments without political interference. Can you give us an idea of what kind of political interference cancer patients may have faced previously?
I don't know if they've faced political interference, but I feel that they've probably been at war with the politicians, you know, in terms of them not abiding by the promise that they made in the run-up to the election. There was just one instance previously when it was indeed the National Party interfered in the Pharmac process and provided Herceptin, even though Pharmac said that it didn't offer good value for money given their current budget constraints. And that was they created actually a new pot of money within the ministry to deliver that. And I think those sort of things are key, and that was a potential risk here. But it's great to see that the new coalition government has recognises the value that Pharmac delivers and the need for it to be able to keep that rigour so it can negotiate good prices for the New Zealand public.
In comparison to other OECD countries, how does New Zealand fare when it comes to access to medicine?
I suspect we're still a way down the list even with this new cash injection. And that's just because of how Pharmac makes decisions within its own budget. So other countries have a process, for example, in England, they have a process where they fast-track decisions so you can get a drug that perhaps doesn't quite have enough evidence to get it over a line. They can approve it and with a view to continue to collect that sort of evidence. So there's other countries where you can, like for the US, for example, you can almost get a drug the day that it gets approved by the FDA. But then, of course, if you look at the US's pharmaceutical budget, it's massive, it's huge, you know, it's kind of almost out of control and they're trying to rein it in now with new processes. So there's always going to be, again, a balance between greater access versus a greater drug budget.
So do you think that the recent funding announcement could boost New Zealand's profile internationally in that area?
Yeah, I'm sure other countries around the world are looking upon New Zealand and seeing what happens, seeing how it changes the nature of the way that we might fund drugs and the fact that we can now fund more. New Zealand's Pharmac, its health technology agency, has always been held up as being a good example of how to make good evidence-based decisions, but being mindful of the budget.
So finally, are there still gaps to accessing medicine and cancer treatments that need to be addressed outside the recent funding increase?
Yeah, and that's not about even the medicines that are available. This is actually about the healthcare system and inequities in accessing the system. There are many people that are missing out on being screened and being diagnosed with cancer. And so actually we need to kind of address that early part of the cancer pathway to then allow them access into a system that now has more cancer drugs for them. And equally at the other end, you know, we need to make sure that people are having a good death and there is appropriate palliative care that's available for people, you know, when they've run out of treatment options.
And that was Paula Lorgelli from the University of Auckland giving us her perspective on the government's recent decision to boost pharmac funding for cancer treatments.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Green Party MP Ricardo Menendez-March, Susan St. John from the University of Auckland, Paula Lorgelli, also from the University of Auckland, Bianca Ranson from Forest and Bird, and Aaron J. Hendry from Kickback. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.